This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky for January 2010. Well, if we look towards the south in the mid to late evening during January, we have one of the most beautiful skyscapes that we can see in the Northern Hemisphere. At its heart is Orion the Hunter, with its three stars forming its belt, and just below the Sword of Orion with the Orion Nebula, a fuzzy little object if you look with binoculars. Those three stars are very good pointers. If you go up and to the right, you'll come first to the Hyades cluster at the heart of Taurus the Bull, with Aldebaran, the red eye of the bull. Now, in fact, Aldebaran is not part of the Hyades cluster. It's about halfway between us and the cluster, and whereas the cluster is actually moving leftwards across the sky, Aldebaran is moving south. Just happens to fit in very nicely. If you keep going beyond the Hyades in the same direction, you'll see that little beautiful cluster of stars, the Pleiades cluster, M45, often called the Seven Sisters. But in fact, with your unaided eye, you'll probably either see about five of them, or if the seeing is very good, the transparency in your eyes are very good, you might well see nine. It's very rare, I think, you'd ever actually see seven. Above Taurus, we have the constellation of Auriga, with the bright star Capella at its height, really, at the top. It's got some very nice clusters within it, open clusters, like the Pleiades and the Hyades, because the Milky Way is running through that part of the sky. And they're M36, M37, and M35, I think. And binoculars might show those a little fuzzy little blobs. Certainly, fairly powerful binoculars will. If you go down to the left of the three stars of Orion's belt, you come to Sirius, the dog star, the brightest star in Canis Major. We don't see the bottom half of Canis Major very well from our northern climb, sadly. Nice thing about Sirius is it has a little companion. It's a white dwarf star, about ninth magnitude. In fact, if Sirius wasn't there, you could see it quite easily with binoculars, but it is lost in the glare of its giant companion star. But a very, very high-quality telescope with very clean optics can actually see this little white dwarf. It's the same sort of star as our Sun will actually end up being at the very end of its life. Well, up to the left of Orion, if you go above Betelgeuse, this very giant red star, it's a supergiant. It's about the size, in fact, of the orbit of Jupiter. So it's an enormous star, probably one of the stars in the northern hemisphere that's next likely to explode in a supernova explosion. You carry on up to the left, you come to Gemini with the stars Castor and Pollux, the heavenly twins. And that's a nice little area as well. Between Betelgeuse and the lower left of Auriga, with binoculars, you might pick up a rather nice star cluster as well, near the foot of the upper twin. And then down to the left of Gemini, you actually have Procyon in Canis Minor, with one other star really only visible very easily. So do enjoy looking at that rather beautiful part of the heavens. Binoculars will be a great help. Okay, well, what about the planets? Well, Jupiter has perhaps been the star of the last few months, seen very well in the west, southwest, just after sunset. It's now getting pretty close to the Sun. It's still in Capricornus, and you can still see it, but it sets by about 7:30 p.m. in mid-January, so you haven't got very much time, and of course it's going to be at low elevation. Magnitude about -2, angular size is still about 35 arc seconds, so if you have a good night when the seeing isn't bad, you may have a chance to see some detail on the surface, like the equatorial bands. They've been showing up quite well in recent weeks. But really, from about mid-January, for a month or so, we're going to have to wait to see it next time, when it comes around before dawn. Now, Saturn has, in fact, passed behind the Sun. It's rising now at about 10:30 p.m. in the middle of January, and it actually goes due south, that's transit, when it's highest in the sky, it's at an elevation of 39 degrees, at about 5 a.m. So if you don't mind getting up early, you'd have a very good chance to have a look at Saturn. The angular size of the disk is about 18 arc seconds. Because Saturn's a long way away, that doesn't actually change very much as we move in orbit around the Sun. Now, as you probably know, the ring system was edge-on a few months ago. It's now still only at 4.9 degrees at the beginning of January, so they'll still appear very thin. And that's one reason why Saturn isn't quite as bright now as it often is. If you have a small telescope, you'll easily pick up its brightest satellite, Titan, which is at magnitude 7.8. And if you've perhaps got a telescope of 8 inches or more, you could well see quite a number of others. I'll mention those in the highlights coming up. Well, Mercury, that passed in front of the Sun, that's called inferior conjunction, on the 4th of January, and it reappears in the pre-dawn sky by the middle of the month. It's probably highest in the sky from the 17th to the 21st of January, but it's still only 6 degrees above the horizon, about 1 hour before sunrise. So it's fairly hard to spot. It's not what we call its best apparition. There are others when it's higher in the sky, just because of the angle of the ecliptic with the horizon. Well, Mars really is the star of this month. It's now becoming prominent in the evening sky, rising soon after sunset at the beginning of January. It'll be well up in the south and highest in the sky around midnight. I'll say more about that in the highlight later on. It crossed from Cancer into Leo, that's moving eastwards, on the 1st of December, and carried on moving eastwards until December the 20th. Then it began its retrograde path westwards and returns into Cancer on January the 9th. So for most of January, it'll be back inside Cancer. Finally, of course, it will carry on, change its direction again, and move eastwards again, passing back into Leo. But that'll take a while. The magnitude increases from about minus 1 to minus 1.2. That's not a lot of difference. And the angular size slowly increases from about 13 to 14 arc seconds. But more of that very shortly. Venus is passing behind the Sun during January and is at superior conjunction. That's when it lies pretty much behind the Sun on January the 11th. We're going to have to wait until the middle of February before we have a reasonable chance of spotting it in the evening sky after sunset. Okay, so what about the highlights of the month? Well, we do have a meteor shower. It's called the Quadrantids. It's basically the early morning of January the 4th. Would in principle give you the best chance of observing it. It should peak at about 5 a.m. that morning. Sadly, this year, we're not best placed to observe it, as the moon is just 4 days after full, and so brightening the sky. Okay, the moon is going to be well over towards the west by then, but nevertheless, it means we'll only see the brighter of the meteors. The radiant, which is where the meteors appear to come from, is in the constellation of Bootes, not far below the tail of Ursa Major, the Great Bear. And that was where there was once a small constellation called the Quadrant. And that was a device used by early astronomers, most notably Tycho, to measure the elevations of stars as they crossed the meridian. Given the time when that happens, you can then work out the star's celestial coordinates. The peak hourly rate of the Quadrantids is about 200, but they're not particularly bright, so a good dark observing sight will help, and as I've said, the moon isn't really going to be a great help to us this year. Well, I've already said that Mars is really going to be at its best during January and February. We have opposition when the Earth passes between Mars and the Sun on Jan the 29th, and in fact, Mars is closest to us on Jan the 27th, when it'll be at a distance of about 100 million kilometres and at a magnitude of minus 1.3. Oppositions of Mars, this is what we call it, they occur at intervals of about 780 days. But because Mars has an eccentric orbit, in fact the Earth has to a lesser extent, the distance of Mars at opposition varies quite widely. If Mars is at its closest point to the Sun, we call that at perihelion, and the Earth at its most distant point, the distance will be the smallest, and so Mars will have the greatest angular size. And you may remember that happened about two apparitions ago when Mars was at its closest for about 60,000 years, had an angular size of 25 arc seconds. At the opposite extreme, when Mars is at aphelion, the angular size only reaches about 14 arc seconds, and sadly this is the case this year, so we're not really going to be able to see as much detail on the surface. Very nicely, it's actually running through the constellation of Cancer, as I mentioned, and will be just above the Beehive cluster around the 27th of January. The moon, actually, near full, will also be in close attendance over the next couple of days. So do have a look at Mars if you can. If you've got a telescope of 4 inches or more, you should be able to see some details. The North Polar Cap is tilted towards us. That's a brilliant white colour. You should certainly be able to see that. Slight pity for small telescopes is that the most prominent dark feature, Syrtis Major, passes behind the limb in the early evening towards the end of January, and so won't be seen best. As Mars' day is similar in length to ours, in fact, you tend to see the same face at the same time for quite a while, so you have to wait a bit till you see some of the other parts of the surface. I mentioned Saturn earlier. Around the 11th of January, there's quite a nice time, if you have a telescope, to have a look at its satellites. Rhea, which is at magnitude 9.7, is very close to Titan, just under magnitude plus 8, and you should see these with a relatively small telescope. Dione is actually close to the rings on Titan's side. That's 10.4 magnitude. Close by, Mimas is at magnitude 12.9. And then on the opposite side of Saturn is Enceladus at magnitude nearly 12. Those would be visible if you have a 8 to 10 inch scope, or if you try and take a sort of a 30 second exposure with a camera, you should be able to pick them up. Well, that's, I think, enough for the highlights this month. Not as many as some, but I think Mars, certainly, if you have a telescope, is something to be looking out for. Well, finally, something for those of you who live in the southern hemisphere, but I hope it'll be of interest to those in the north as well. Close by to the small Magellanic Cloud, which will be fairly low in the southwest in the evening, is a globular cluster called 47 Tucani. We usually call it 47 Tuck for short. Now, it's normally regarded as the second brightest globular cluster in the sky, second to Omega Centauri, which is also a southern hemisphere object. But there's a bit of doubt about Omega Centauri, which may well be the nucleus of a galaxy whose outer parts have been stripped off due to the proximity of our own Milky Way galaxy. So it could be 47 Tuck is the biggest and brightest of our globular clusters at magnitude 4. It dates from the time when our galaxy was formed about 12 billion years ago, is a spherical group of stars about 120 light years across, and has a mass of about 1 million solar masses. So that's the order of number of stars within it. They are very tightly packed towards the centre, only about one-tenth of a light year apart. The nearest star to us, our own sun, is 4.2 light years away, so that's pretty tight. And that has actually had an effect upon objects that we call neutron stars, and specifically those we call pulsars, which are rotating neutron stars that, as they rotate, send out beams of usually radio, occasionally light waves, that sweep around the sky like an interstellar lighthouse. When these are born, they might typically be spinning 30 to 50 times a second, but they relatively quickly slow down. However, if a slow neutron star, it may well have actually stopped being a pulsar once they rotate less than about twice every second, they don't really emit very easily. If one of these happens to be close to a larger star passing close by, these things still have got the mass, typically more than of our sun, about 1.2 solar masses. And so they can attract material off the passing star. This transfers angular momentum to them, and they spin up. And many of them become what are called millisecond pulsars, whose periods can be measured in milliseconds, spinning quite quickly. The fastest known millisecond pulsar is spinning about 716 times per second. In the heart of 47 Tucani, astronomers have now discovered about 26, 27 of these millisecond pulsars. And their periods raise upwards from about 50 hertz through several hundred hertz. If you apply the pulse rate as we receive it on Earth, these are radio pulses, of course, to a loudspeaker cone, because the pulses are so rapid, we don't hear them as pulses, we hear a tone. And so you could argue that these are sort of singing stars in a sort of funny way. We've put a special link in to get you to those sounds easily. If you go to jodcast.net/pulsar sounds, that will give you the website on which we have the pulsar sounds of some individual pulsars, and at the bottom, in fact, you can listen to 16 of the pulsars within 47 Tacconi, individually first and then as a sort of a stellar cacophony at the end. So jodcast.net/pulsar sounds. Well, I hope you enjoy listening to that, and have a very good month observing the sky.